Welcome to the Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views, as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter @securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
So this is interesting time, right? Because what I'm wrestling with right now, I mean, from one aspect, I think we're in an amazing era right now, that as we look at what's going on right now with Ukraine and Russia, the amount of information that we can get, you know, we've been, you know, watching some of our threat intelligence feeds that are coming through, and just the instantaneous pull together of everything that's going together. But I begin to wonder, in the context of the CISO and our security organizations, relevant to what's going on over there, that are we inflating our value in thinking that we need to have huge concerns about what's going over there, or are we justified? And this is the inflection point now, that as we look at a fairly physical war, now there's a lot of cyber elements to it, but this is the inflection point where now, kind of the lack of better term, I'll say the rise of the CISO, right? That if you look at now, this could have major implications.
This is what it's all been leading up to, you mean?
Well, right.
It remains to be seen, but I think we have to act as though it is. You know, we won't know. History, the judging of history comes afterward.
Right.
But I think that that all of the actions that are being taken now, the approaches that we are, you know, the controls we're putting in, the response we're putting in, the monitoring we're putting in, the actions, the plans, activating the plans, all of these things were with something like this in mind. Now, we didn't know exactly what it would look like, but we knew that nation state attackers, we knew that outside some kind of something elsewhere with a lot of power and a lot of money and a lot of drive behind it was a very likely scenario. I don't know that we've seen it quite to the scale that it will be when it's all said and done yet, but I do know that, you know, I wouldn't have changed anything except for perhaps going more and, you know, being even more prepared. You can always say, you know what, we didn't need it. But you can't say, boy, I really wish I had put more in and more, you know, more preparedness for an event like this. I think let's talk in, you know, hopefully a year when we can look back and look at impacts and look at what actually happened and say, you know, all right, then it was warranted. And honestly, Eric, even if it wasn't warranted this time, I do think that the paths we're taking are appropriate based on the directionality of, you know, based on the trajectory of the kind of attacks, the nature of attacks, the source of attacks, the impact of attacks, and the fact that everything we've got is technology driven.
I'll take it right one step further, because I think what you're talking about is the importance of, if something should happen within an organization being attacked with some type of malware or fallout from something that was used over there. But let's take it one step further, though. Everybody went to bed, was it Wednesday night or Tuesday night, right? And woke up in the morning to headlines saying that, you know, Ukraine's been invaded. You know, there's information about some type of new wiper out there. Everybody should be, the second your executives get into the office, they're like, I heard all of us are being attacked right now from some type of cyber this, cyber that. And where I'm going is, it's not the disinformation, it's the unknown, and who's the first person they turn to. So they turn to the security organization. What should we know? What should we be worried about, right? That person right there is getting information. You know where to go, Eric, Dan, you know where to go, whether it's CISA, whether it's these feeds, certain organizations that supply threat intel. You're talking to your threat intel teams that you work with, right? Or companies you work with. And you're gathering what's known, what's unknown, what's real, what's speculation. And now you're the one that can sit down and explain to management, say, here's what we know. Here's what we don't know. You can always say the word what if. I can remember, I think it was the second grade or third grade when we had a police officer come in to talk to our, you know, classroom. And when it came time for questions, I was like, well, what if somebody walks up behind you and tries taking your gun? You know, what if? And he goes, there's always going to be a million what ifs.
Right.
Here's what I.
Yeah, that's an infinite space. Yeah,
here's what I can tell you. And executives would appreciate that because, not to take it back to manufacturing, you go to bed at night, you wake up, you find out your plant's down. There's already something in the news about this or that, has nothing to do with even cyber. And the first thing you do is call your plant manager. What do we know? What do we don't know? Right. And now this, you are the plant manager. You're the business manager for these cyber outcomes.
But in this case, they're actually, let's take it one step before that. The discussions, even before we got to attacks and potential, you know, technology issues, was one, how are our people, the people that are in the affected regions? And I need to really give some huge applause because I've heard this, I've experienced this in a few places over the last week and heard it from others, that the first question was, how are our people? If those that have operations in the area, those that have people in the area, staff, outsource software development, there's a huge 300,000 software development professionals in Kyiv itself that are doing work mostly for, you know, further west. So it was that. It was, what are our threats? Or sorry, what are the risks we have? What data do we have there? What machines do we have there? Do we have controls and to be able to manage the things that are on our own? So the applause comes. I heard more people talk about what do we have before, how are we getting attacked? And I think that's a really good approach. And it means that again, back to the prep work, that we've started to instill this risk management mindset and thinking through the chain from internal out, rather than, oh no, the headlines say we're being attacked. And so I just want to give that credit. And I'd be curious if you guys have heard the same things about thinking about what are our internal risks? What do we have? How are our people? And then we start to look outward and say, all right, now how do we continue to defend?
Yeah, and that, I mean, to a certain extent, I mean, if you look at the automotive manufacturing, that's kind of a natural progression anyways. Every conversation around manufacturing, the first thing is safety. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if we're just talking about manufacturing or if we're talking about what's going on over there. People first, right? People are core to the organization. I would like to believe, I would hope every organization is getting to that point that they see it that way. But certainly in this case, it's looking at what's the impact to the people that are part of this. I'll tell you though, I mean, it's amazing watching this play out. Not only from, I mean, kind of hearts going out to the Ukrainian people and what's going on. There's no frame of reference I can put it in, right? Where I have any understanding, but just watching the level of empathy that goes through that. But this is back to the inflection point. This is the first time that I think we have watched an event like this play out where we have I don't want to say a direct role, an indirect role, because of the potential impact that it could have to
we organizations. Be people in our and roles in the security,
in the security community at large. I mean, we've seen a call come out from the Ukrainian president about getting hackers together to help them out. I mean, it's mainstream. We're there. But it's interesting. And I think as we think about this in the context on the, you know, as we were talking about, are we being attacked? Are we being attacked? You know, the conversation I've tried to draw back to, let's go to what we do know. And if we go back before this even happened, that it comes back to the idea, and we've talked about this on the podcast, of knowing who your adversary is, knowing what their motives are. So if we do it and say, all right, the adversary is Russia, we know based on their profile, the tools, the techniques that they're using. And we also know that they love to play the mass disruption mm-hmm. game. So are we directly in the crosshairs of who they're going after? No, not likely. But if you think about it from a collateral damage perspective, that is something we've already seen this play out in their playbook. Look at NotPetya. Drawing that back, that was the Russians. Now, granted, that was directed at Ukraine, but look at the mass impact it had on global scale. they're not afraid to pull that card. And it's almost the cyber nuclear option. And my biggest concern is if they continue to become isolated, cornered, will they play that card? And we've already seen groups, Conti and others, come out in saying that if you attack Russia, we're going to attack you. I think this is still early stages. This is going to be interesting.
Without question. And one note just for listeners, you know, there's been this plea for people with technology, with technology and security skills to come to the aid of the Ukraine. And at least for the United States, being part of that or volunteering and participating in some of that is actually against U.S. law, or it may very well be against U.S. law. I am not a lawyer. I'm not your lawyer, but look into that before you go and engaging in that. I know there's a great desire to help, but be aware of the implications of engaging in that kind of a hackback, especially from within the U.S. in a time in which we're not actually engaged in any kind of conflict. That's the end of my Dan spends too much time with lawyers speech.
That was a good disclosure.
But but there's a lot of truth though to what the concerns should be, right? Because you, Eric, when you brought up, it was December 2015 when the Ukraine power grid was first attacked. And I think it's very carnal knowledge that from the game of chess, Russian youth begins playing the game of chess at a very, very young age. And it's something that you begin in the classroom. And if you've ever been to cafes in Russia, people are sitting outside playing young, old grandparents. If you go back and look at the activity, there's a great book called Sandworm. And Sandworm is related to NotPetya. Sandworm is related to so many different attacks that have occurred over the years that then have been corresponded back to Russia. And particularly when you look at the Ukraine, the steps that were taken during each step of the attack, and then the same thing with Estonia, was very much a game of chess. Let's do this first. What is their reaction? What's the world's reaction? Okay, let's do that plus this. What does Ukraine do? Let's do that plus this plus this. How can we get a reaction from them and the rest of the world to see what happens as we escalate that? And part of it was understanding that as you do those things in combination, what does the country do in response from a cyber side? What things do they start shutting off to protect themselves? And if they shut off enough stuff, can we reduce the visibility that the rest of the world has on that country? And those were some of the first steps leading up to this between some of the DDoS attacks and everything else. And it's not often that I give a huge round of applause to Elon Musk, but when the internet was severed completely in the Ukraine, I don't think Putin expected Starlink to go ahead and just slide on over and be able to provide internet access to the Ukrainian people. And that's to keep the visibility and the flow of information, but also it could be disinformation coming out, that at least there's a flow of information that keeps the world abreast of what's going on.
Yeah, and it's also an interesting paradigm shift. It demonstrates an interesting paradigm shift in access, in how access has been traditionally blocked at national perimeters, and now there's a different method of going after it. Now, of course, this of course now opens up a new avenue for attack. I'm interested to watch satellite hacking. There's some interesting security of satellites that one of my friends is developing higher education programs around information security for satellites. So I guess that might just got jettisoned into the new into the forefront in regular internet connectivity. So let's take this back. I guess, Brian, the things you described from the last set of attacks, are we seeing the same kind of parallels to today? Is it the same approach?
It very much the same approach. In the first steps of this were some DDoS attacks, a little bit of misinformation or misguided information going out in the weeks leading up to it, right? In 2015, there was a little bit of stack up of military, not like we saw in the last few months, but they used some of those DDoS attacks to go ahead and try to, you know, hit the infrastructure of the Ukraine and then Estonia, and see what they would do first, what things they would shut off to try to get it under control. And what we saw with WhisperGate and the Hermetic Wiper, two different forms of wiper malware that were both used in this most recent attack, were very similar to some of the malware used back in 2015. Now, remember this, back in 2015, it took 5 years to fingerprint and to put sanctions on the people that we believe did it, which were all of Russian origin, right? Everyone knew, you know, even a few weeks after the 2015 attacks, pretty sure who it was, right? You could almost say with, and I don't want to use the word 99%, but they very much knew where these attacks were coming from. But that's how long it took before anybody could actually, and I think it was, yeah, the United States attorney actually went ahead and said, this is who we know did it. And we're going to go ahead and bring up grand jury indictments against six alleged people. And I'm going to throw this out there, Unit 7455. So it's a group out of Russia. And we very much saw the same things leading up to this. Now, the second that full-scale attack hits, this is a little bit different than what happened last time, because last time all the lights went out. And then the first lights, when they came back on, showed missiles going from Ukraine towards Russia. And it was like, oh, look, they attacked us. But you didn't see what happened when the lights went off. What we're seeing this time, obviously, that's different, in information that we have going back, you know, a year and a half, our government could say with pretty good precision that they expected an attack to happen in the early part of 2022, not cyber, just cyber, but an actual attack against the Ukraine. And some people may say, well, then why didn't we do more to try to stop it? And this is that political chess game, right? Who's allies, who's not allies, what actually leads to world wars today, right? That makes things so difficult. And this is where the world of disinformation, and I'm not talking just Russia, just disinformation or lack of understanding of what a lot of these agreements are, how NATO's involved, how the UN's involved, who is allies of the UN, who's allies of China, who's allies of different European unions, who's allies of Russia. Understanding all those political ties leads you back to why this is such a game of chess, right? And the lack of understanding of that leads to not just disinformation, but misunderstanding. And I think that's where, going back to Eric's statement of, is this the, you know, the inflection point of the CISO becoming, you know, his role becoming that of both, you know, master and commander within the company. Right. And I truly do believe when the board, when the CEO really wants to understand, you know, what should we be worried about? What is true and what is not true? The CISO and the cyber team within that organization probably have not only a better pulse on what's the real threat intel, but within the cyber community, what things to be looking at, right? You saw the paper that came out from CISA, you know, the Shields Up, and a lot of really good information on that, or within that paper. But then how do you disseminate that for the board or for your CEO? You don't just say, hey, go read this 10-page paper, right? Now your job is to find a way to articulate to them what the government's saying, what you know, what we've done to be prepared, right? And there should always be a worry out there. There's nothing that's 100%.
Right. We always joke with everybody about, don't get worried until you see me get worried. If all of a sudden you see a security person all of a sudden get concerned about an issue, all right, it's time to start being concerned, because I mean, we're kind of useless. This becomes day to day now, not this exact situation. This is obviously ramped up into a different level. But it's interesting, because I know leading up to this, you know, I'm sure a lot of organizations and a lot of CISOs got the question of, should we be doing something different? What else should we be doing? And, you know, as I think about the question in and of itself, that almost implies that we're leaving something on the table, right? Now, certainly there's probably a higher level scrutiny applied to certain types of alerts, certain types of traffic trends, threat intelligence, stuff that's coming in. But by and large, I mean, this is day-to-day activity. And that's the interesting thing about security, right? Comparing security to traditional IT operations, that, you know, if you look at the up down of a firewall and stuff like that, it's fairly, I don't want to say it's predictable, but there's leading indicators when something's going to go up, something's going to go down. You can start looking at, you know, whether the fans, stuff like that. But as you transition over into security operations, it is a very nonlinear, you never know when it's going to happen. So this is a typical life for us anyways, that we're always watching. There's always something going on, just waiting for what next. It's an interesting,
but but that question about what more, what else could we be doing? I think it also is important though to tie, and we know that we have, you know, that we have listeners of this that are not in the security realm, but that question comes up. And I think you have to put it in the context of historically, and even to today, and rightfully so, we make these balanced risk business decisions. And we don't always have all of the pieces in place that we would like to, because we've had to either trade off because there's only so much money to be able to do A or B, or some kind of control would cripple the business and the function of the business that we're part of. And therefore we don't have, you know, we haven't put a control in place that might be able to stop it. So I think it's important when asked those kind of things to be able to revisit some of those discussions and say, we've done this, we've done this, we've purposely not done this, which means we don't have this kind of exposure. Do I think right now we should change that? And give some answers about that as well. Not that you want to go back and start switching up all of your tech or switching your approaches during an attack, but helping people understand the places where we have visibility and where we do have some blind spots. I'm going to attempt an automotive reference, so bear with me. It's going to go badly, I'm sure. But you know, the idea that we have, you know, we can't drive around in glass cars, in completely glass, enclosed in glass. We have to have some frames. And those frames are there for the structure of the automobile, but it means that there's parts we can't actually see. Literal blind spots. And I think the same kind of thing applies here. We have to put in some structural things or keep some structural things in our desire to make the whole thing gorgeous in glass. But as therefore, you know, there's going to be things we miss along the way because they're blocked by those frames. But helping people understand what's on the other side and what we know we can't see, the known unknowns, that's as much a part of our role as information security leaders and practitioners as it is to roll out tech that blocks, defends, detects, et cetera.
Right.
Dan, bravo, bravo. And I truly do mean that, because the original cars and as car production ramped up was just like the original internet, right? Like the internet was created, you had all these connections. You look at, you know, the Morse worm, right? It was so easy back in the day because the speed of everything was increasing, but you also had as much access as you want. I mean, this goes back to, I'm going to mess this up here. I'll pull it up. There's a memory I have of a book I was just reading called The Dawn of the Code War. And inside there, it goes back to talk about when we really found out that Russia was inside of our environment, listening and knowing everything that was going on. And this was like 20 years ago, guys, right? So this goes back to car manufacturing. Cars were just being pumped out at an unprecedented rate. But as the speed of the car and everything else increased, the safety measures weren't, the braking systems didn't get better. There's no such thing as an airbag. I mean, even seatbelts back in the day were just right over the lap, right? Your head was straight down. And people were like, you know what? We need to step back and start putting some controls, because you started looking at the numbers, the analytics of how many people get hurt, number of accidents, like anything over 25 miles an hour. Do people get injured? A lot of people die, right? Like they started looking at that and saying, hey, we need to do something. And the same thing happened. It wasn't until you were really putting the information out there of how exposed we were, because people really didn't know. Really? These other countries are reading everything we're doing? They know everything that's going on because it's that easy to not, it's not even that they're breaking in. They're just, hey, you're leaving everything open. Like this is the wild, wild west in the internet, right? But yeah, I totally agree with you, Dan. It was driving around in glass cars. And at some point you're like, well, how do we improve upon this? And Eric, you said it before. You know, security is kind of like the brakes of a race car, right? Like, you know, you want to go as fast as you can to win, but coming in and around a corners, every now and then you have to hit the brakes or else you're going to lose control.
Yeah, it's interesting, the complexities at play. I mean, if you go back, you know, Actually, the book you reference, I'm looking at my bookshelf. I think I've got that sitting on there. I just haven't read through it yet. But you think about the complexities at play, the evolution of security over time, right? And the way we protect it. And now, I mean, you have the conversation and before we started recording, you know, I kind of like what you mentioned, Brian, that if you think about somebody firing a missile or a nuclear weapon or something like that, it's a physical instantiation of something, you know, where it came from. But in the context of the digital world and cyber, many times you don't know. I mean, think about it. Think about how many of us over time have played with the different rules for blocking certain geographies and IPs. Even that is going by the wayside, that's not foolproof anymore, that you understand where something is actually coming from. It's much, much more complex. And then you add on top of that, that all of these different groups that are at play are very adept at finding and holding on to zero days. So I think a part of this is just kind of sitting on the edge of the seat. Okay, what's next? You know, are we going to see something hit? I mean, if we go back to, what were the ones that were that came out from the NSA that were found on a server? I'm drawing a blank on the name.
As of recently or back like around...
It was a couple years ago. That's where WannaCry came from.
Eternal Blue. I don't know that it was ever named, but yeah, it was a pile of ODAs from...
Oh, no, that was Black Energy. Wasn't that Black Energy 1, 2, and 3?
That might have been part of it. I'm trying to think. There was an attacker.
Oh, the Shadow Brokers.
Shadow Brokers. That started to use that. Now it took me so long to get there. I forget where I was going with it. but you think about it. I mean, so look what happened when Shadow Brokers, when the NSA exploits came out that were 0 days, and the havoc that was able to WannaCry and all of that came out, that you begin to wonder, are we going to see the same thing here? Because again, we know definitively that these groups, inclusive of our own NSA, that hold on to these 0 days just in case something happens, that if they have to be used for cyber war. But
Eric, you bring up a great point, though, because some of the weapons that they used, they took directly from the NSA. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
And then it's like, well, NSA, why weren't you telling anybody about this stuff? Or name the government institution. And it's, well, now look at what we're going through today. This becomes the point in time where you say, well, these are the reasons we held on to some of those things so we could be ready in case we needed to use them. Does that make them culpable in a way if there's never is a war and those things end up getting used? And this comes right back to what we were talking about. The CISO in his role at the company, right, has this brought it to the forefront about not only why he's that important, but also being able to explain to the business of why these things happen, right? Like, there's a new type of malware out there. It may take time before you fingerprint where it actually came from. And that can take a lot of time. That's not the CISO's job to go back and be able to fingerprint where that stuff, you know, the history or evolution of where this came from, right? That's the forensic side of the business, being able to go back and actually fingerprint. And that takes a lot of time. That takes, Eric, and you said this earlier before we started recording, there are experts in that field that if you wanted to pay them to come work for you, could rival some of your budgets for the year, right? Just to have that type of skill set. And that's why we do rely on, and it's not companies like mine. There are very, very specific companies out there that's what they're engaged in all the time. And that's why the government goes out to hire people to come in to be able to do that.
Right. And I think what you just raised, though, I think is equally, is really, really important to put into the context of the business operations, the organization as a whole. This is why, one of the core reasons why those that are about system management and maintenance shouldn't be thinking find it very difficult to also think about it in the context of security, because now you have service back to the service resumption, keep the systems up, keep them going, versus find out what happened, maybe keep things offline. So you now have the CISO, we'll use the CISO CIO conflict, or the CISO CIO push and pull, that this is why we have the roles that we do in the information security organization that are abstracted from the run the business type operations, because you have to have those logical conversations and find out again where that right balance is. But this is why we do that preparation, bringing this all the way back around to the original question Eric asked, all of the preparation, all of the work is so that when something does happen or when the threat of something happens, you can have that meaningful pull and push discussion with the with an IT or an operations counterpart to be able to say, where do we want to live along this continuum, with each providing their own great security debate on how to, on what is the right answer for that particular organization. And that preparation, Eric, to come back to your original question, that preparation is key on days like this, when we can have those kind, when we have to have those kind of conversations. The relationship is there, the insight and understanding of each other's world is there, the understanding of the technology and the function of the organization, of what that company sells or does, or what that organization's mission is. All of those are key in the preparatory work, because you now have this outside X factor that you have to account right. for, where you don't know all the details. And these two sides, along with, you know, business operations and you know the material parts of what the company is, will inform that kind of discussion and decision in a way. And if you're just having that conversation for the first time last week Tuesday, it's not a good thing.
Yeah, that's how I've always liked using the analogy of the security team being like the pit crew for a race. Right, that we don't know exactly what's going to happen in the changing dynamic of the races, or a spin out that hits our car that we now have to fix something, but we do know that something will happen during the race. We're going to have to service that car, and our whole goal is as fast as possible, get it in, do the work that's necessary, and get that car back on the track to win. That's our focus from a security perspective. We don't know what's going to happen, but we do know that we're going to prepare in advance, that we're going to test the air guns. We're going to test getting over the pit. This is the kind of the training while you do tabletops and all of this, something will happen. I wanted to call attention and to real quick, because I was looking at the hermetic wiper. So for those listening, so that is the malware that's being called, that's been used in Ukraine to essentially render hard drives and stuff worthless, right? And kudos to the Sentinel One team, because they've got a phenomenal write-up with the IOCs and all the parts of it. But what I wanted to call out, because I think we've talked about it on this before, is ransomware being used as a smokescreen, and we just saw it. We just saw it, that ransomware was deployed. Why? Because everybody is so laser focused on ransomware, that all of a sudden the head pivots and you don't ask the question, all right, what's going on over right. here? And this is the complexity game of cat and mouse of cybersecurity that we have to continue to pay attention to, that we cannot get laser focused on one little event, because there may be something. And we've seen this play out with DDoS before. And unfortunately, DDoS, you know, as we've kind of talked, is coming back again. Everything, nothing actually goes away, right? It's back in style again, which is absolutely amazing. But the whole concept of a smoke screen that, you know, we've seen it play out. If you go back to, you know, World War II and other actual physical wars, it was used in physical wars, but we're seeing it in a hot new way in cyber. And it's a
nerve. You bring up a great point there, you know, smokescreen, ransomware used here, and all of a sudden everything's focused in this direction and you turn back this way and something else is going on. And I forget what it was a year ago, Dan, me, you and Eric were all on, something happened and the conversation was, and this was very much a real conversation business wise. And Eric, you had said, do I shut everything off? Or is that what they're planning on me to do, so that when I turn it back on during that startup period, there was something there just waiting?
So it was SolarWinds we were talking about.
Because everybody unplugged. Now think about this also. Who was involved in SolarWinds? Right? There's a lot of speculation that people are 99% sure that it was Russia, right? And also then China had some fingerprints on it as well. Now, if you are an avid chess player and you've played it a very, very long time and you allowed everybody to see that you were there and allowed the world to call you out somewhat, but what did you witness? What every American business would do. So when something else happens, maybe we will let them see that something else is out there. Everybody might unplug and then boom. And I'm just putting it out there because this goes back to the game of chess. And what you said, Eric, you launched this, you've made the world afraid of ransomware over the last 3.5 years. It goes back longer, but really in the last 3.5 years, so that when this happens, I know the response of almost every organization because these playbooks have been made and organizations have talked about them and it's put out there through a lot of different literature and blogs and groups. And they're watching those things of how to do that or how to be prepared for that. So, and back to the pit crew analogy, I love that one, Eric, because there are times where that car will come in and you've tested all your air guns and everything else, but the tool you may turn to could be duct tape just for the next 30 minutes to keep something, you know, some broken part down so that there's no extra drag coefficient for the time being, right? And that could go to CPU utilization or something else. You duct tape it down because you know once this race is over, right, or this attack is over, I'm going to be able to go in, fix this, clean this, put the new part back on and rebuild that piece of structure. But there's so much truth to that.
So, Brian, though, the thing you just mentioned around chess, around understanding moves, understanding how people will react, that also, though, can get inside people's heads, the idea of, but that's what they want me to do, so I won't do it. But then but if I don't do it, then they will. And you start to get into this cycle of trying to outguess your opponent to the point where you actually don't make any action or you make very ill-advised actions. So I guess for both of you, the thought on, you know, taking the, how do you take that into account when you start to think that maybe this ransomware is fake? So maybe I shouldn't put my attention on it because now what are they hiding? We have limited resources. We have, you know, honestly, at the end of the day, if somebody truly wants to get into our organizations or into whatever, they're going to be able to do so. How do you bring that into your calculus, the response side of it? Because one, the misdirection might just be freak you out. One, it might be legitimate, but you might not have anything else you can do. How do you take that into account?
From my perspective, that comes back to building the structure. You know, I think I'm going to draw this back to incident response and tabletop exercises and defining the roles that people play. Because when an incident, so we'll pick on ransomware happens, you have the technical team, they're focused on containment, eradication, and then you start moving into how did he get in, making sure that everything's plugged. You have kind of a manager that's watching over that team, right? That's your pure tactical team. And I see the role of a CISO or whoever's leading the security organization has to be cognizant of detaching from that tactical. There has to be somebody that's got an outside perspective. And the way we've kind of set that up is being a communication proxy point, mm-hmm. right? Nobody is allowed to talk to the technical team. They do what they do. I'll disseminate that information where it needs to go. And at the same time, making sure that I'm detached, holistic point of view on what's going on so that somebody is cognizant of, well, it might not just be here. What else could be going on around the organization?
Yeah, I've been experienced similar things where you have to be that broker, and I think the CISO as well. The CISO, or if you're lucky enough to truly have a trained incident manager, is a really good place to go. Although the incident manager would typically be focused on making sure people are getting their deliverables out, but having somebody who is focused on the thought and the analysis and synthesis of the whole situation. And being that trusted advisor and guidance and I guess continuum lever setter, that's a horrible word. That just undid the analogy, the benefits of the analogy before. able to set that place on the continuum.
I was going to throw out there though, this goes back to the communication amongst the organizations that you're in, not just the organization you work for, but those organizations like, you know, whether it's the CSA, whether it's your ties to information from CISA, all those different groups and peers and everybody else you have to turn to, you also have 2,000 other friends that are playing the same game of chess, right?
Yeah,
true.
And so you go back to like the Hermetic Wiper you were talking about, that just wasn't one company. There is sets of companies all involved on sharing that information, right? And the government and several different researchers from each organization all working together very collectively. So if you have, and I was opening up like, you know, the top 10 chess players in the world, right? So if you had like a Magnus or a Garry Kasparov, you know, or a Bobby Fischer out there that's part of a collective team, right? And he can share information, being able to ping people, you know, your peers to say, hey, what would Kasparov do in this situation, right? Because he's seen 10 moves that can stem from this one move, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's another point of, you know, inactivity is one thing. You could just sit there and be like, well, maybe they want me to do this, so I'm not going to do anything. But then being able to turn to your buddy who is playing the same game of chess and say, in this situation, have you experienced this before? And there might be several people in a row that say, no, 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 before someone says, here's what we've seen before. I can't tell you if it's the right thing or the wrong thing, you know, but here's what this person's saying as well. That's part of this collective community. And that's also why when the CEO or the board says, what do we do? The people you work with are the experts on that, right? Not the people they typically work with.
Right. And it's, you know, draw back attention to what Dan said earlier. If you're just having some of the conversations around this, you know, in light of what's going on, too late, right? I mean, hate to point the finger at that, but it's critically important to walk through the paces, to have those conversations early on and know who you're calling. You know, as we think about some smaller businesses, you know, people coming from smaller businesses that may be listening, not everybody is as fortunate to have bigger teams and structure that some of us have. But I think it becomes even more critical to understand who's your first phone call. We've got some amazing capabilities here in the state of Michigan as we start to think about the state police and then getting up into connecting with local FBI offices. There's a lot of support that could come that's not even directly from the security community, but it's important to make sure that you know where you're going to go when this happens so you're not scrambling.
Yeah, but also at the same time, it's never too late. I want to counter what you said. It's never too late. Don't just give up and throw up your hands. If you're just starting, if you don't have this stuff in place, we're recording this on the 27th of February. By the time this airs, you know, the whole world could have changed in the next 24 hours before this gets out into your podcast app. But it's never too late to get started. It may not be as effective as it could have been had you started before, but it doesn't mean give up. Please don't give up. But you do have to end up starting in, you know, in a different place. And I'm going to throw up an image that my friend Doug Brush put together, and you know, talks about the kill chain. If you're on audio, come over to the YouTube and take a look at this. We'll make sure it's visible. But the idea that we are now on actions on objective, all the other parts of the kill chain, we're now too late. But now we need to focus on how to actively understand the intrusion, what information is being taken out, how things are being destroyed, and how we prevent the further movement of that intrusion. So something to keep in mind. It's never too late, but certain options are now off the table for this particular case. But be cognizant of what you're learning as a result of it and incorporate them into the next version of your information security service. After we get through this, be able to reflect on the things you would have done or the things you learned or the things that others have learned and build that into your program.
And one thing I was going to put out there too, and this was based on a conversation that was had this last week, and this is where the business is getting more and more and more and more involved in understanding what their risk is, what their risk exposure is, but what their financial risk is. And this goes to the insurance side of the business. One of the speakers that I had the opportunity to listen to talked about that they very much spend a lot of time talking with the US government about what not to get involved in, meaning if you're setting the bar at what the correct security posture is, right, from the government standpoint, and this goes, you know, the private, you know, versus the different sectors. And they said that they believe that the insurance industry is going to start setting that bar because of the cost of cyber policy. And they believe that that was the right approach to it, that brings it more to the eye of the business stakeholders that then say, okay, from a cost standpoint, why does it cost this much? And it starts asking the question, why is my insurance company and my cyber policy cost X? And it brings it right back down to the CISO, who now comes in to say, here's why. Let me explain what the business risks are and why these companies are setting the policies this way from a cost standpoint, right? Because it very much is a cost avoidance standpoint from an insurance company, which is also then for the same business, cost avoidance, right? Depending on how you parallel those two together. So now it very much brings the CISO into the conversation from a business aspect, business cost, business risk. And now when we have these type of global incidents occurring, an actual war where cyber is being used, but also disinformation, because you read the news and you have Conti ransomware group saying that if any country out there participates in supporting any type of cyber attack against the Russian government, that we will attack your businesses, right? Think about when you show up on Monday and your CEO is going, did you see, I heard that Conti is coming after all American businesses. I got a text from a friend who told me this, right? And you're like, okay, hold on. Here's why they're saying that, right? One of it is to scare people, right? There's a little bit of, I won't call it disinformation, but using that information to put fear in people. And what's the first thing you do when you have fear? Self-preservation, right? So now it becomes the CISO's job. I'm not saying talk people off the ledge, but be able to explain to them, well, what risks do we have, right? Here's the risks that we have. Here's all the things that we've done. And it's like, okay, so you have put an airbag down there, you know, filled all the way up so that if I get pushed off, I'm going to land perfectly right there in the center. The air is gently going to come down and I'm going to be able to stand up out of this thing, right? Should I fall off the building? Yes, that's what I did, right? I didn't tell you about this or this or this, but that was part of those presentations I was giving around, you know, sustainability and everything else. Like, ah, okay. Thank you, Eric. I appreciate it. Right. Like those are the things. Sorry, Dan, go ahead.
But two things. One, right now, there is an extremely good chance that none of your insurance policies will pay out because this is an act of war. This is a carve out.
Yep.
This is anything related to this will likely have no ability to pay. We're seeing more and more of that. So, you know, yeah, so to come back to your question about the insurance industry driving this, I disagree. I think as long as the insurance industry is profit driven, this won't necessarily be, they will not necessarily do it in the best interest of the constituents, of the subscribers. They will do it in the best interest of profit. Now, I'm not against profit. I think profit's really good. But the driving cost, I feel the same way about healthcare. And I don't want to go down that path. Healthcare is not good in the United States because insurance has made it not good in the United States.
True. But Eric, back me up here. If the policies are becoming more expensive, if this is happening, if there's certain things being put in place that if you don't do this, what it's doing is it's leveling up enterprise security, right? It's taking the risk and reducing the overall risk. Now, if the business still believes that the insurance policy is the thing that's ultimately going to save them when everything else fails, they're still misunderstanding and this is where I'm going, that what I'm saying is the insurance companies are raising the bar, right? And Eric, I think you said this before, if you want to see your risk, lower the level of water to see what things are out there. It's the same thing is right. True though, raise that, right? And all boats rise with the tide.
But you're also seeing more and more companies self-insure because they're not getting that from their insurance providers. They're putting cash reserves aside, maybe not sufficient, maybe sufficient. It remains to be seen. This has been, you know, for quite some time now on this topic, on the information security topic. I think there's potential, but I don't think the trajectory right now is that this is a helpful industry, that this is helping us get to a better place.
I think it's got the potential. I mean, I think you have to decouple intent and outcomes, right? If the outcomes are you gain a couple more companies that are now at a better risk posture than they were before, okay, it's probably a win. What's interesting to me though on the policies themselves, because I agree, Dan, they're becoming more and more expensive and they are statistically paying out less and less, right? So it's all about financial gain. But what you're also starting to see is other policies linking to the cyber policy that I've heard of, D&O insurance and some others that have had carve outs in there that if you don't have a cyber insurance policy, guess what? We're not going to pay out on this policy.
Sounds like insurance collusion to me.
It's interesting, but I do. I mean, my biggest fear, Brian, is, and we've talked about this on here, that if insurance companies start dictating technology, then we are in for a big problem. Because I mean, look at just the three of us. That if you ask us a question around how to implement a certain architecture, you may get 10 different ways to do it. None of them being wrong. They're just
different. Except for the one that uses and Teams. That's wrong.
but that's the complexity. That's the nature of our business, that there are multiple ways to go about it depending on the organization, the risk tolerances. And I think if we get to a point where it becomes insurance dictatorship, that all of those potential gains we might have made on some companies that now have more technology or more less risk than they did before, I think we're going to start reversing that, and we will unwind the goals that we were trying to
achieve. And looking ahead, the formulary, you know, the idea of the drug formulary is exactly that. And that's that directionality is where it sounds like, where it feels like things are heading in this space too. And that's what worries me.
See, and Dan, notice, right, why boards or CEOs would go to Eric to understand what's happening versus Brian, because the second you challenged me, I immediately reacted. And then when I asked Eric to stand up for me, he led right in with a very calm response, driven very well, probably well accepted by the board and everybody else. Meanwhile, I'm still sitting here defending and arguing. I agree with both of you. And that's why I said, it's when I say setting the bar, it's creating a higher bar, right? Because of the cost associated with it. But the second they start dictating technology, and I agree with you there, it's not that they're dictating companies that you have to go work with, but they are starting to say what technologies you have to have in place. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, with anything that comes out of this in the next, and when I say comes out of any type of repercussions from Russia, cyber attack wise, from any groups operating within their boundaries aimed at the US, if you haven't been talking about this and preparing for it, and all you did was put a bunch of technology in place, but you don't have any people, you're not going to have the right answer to give to the board or anybody else when it comes in. It's like,
I can't
right.
help but feel we did an episode about that.
It's so very true. But again, you put people in place, right, to be able to make decisions around the technologies you bought. And at the end of the day, you do need leaders. You do need people in those positions to be able to explain to the board, to try to disseminate what is disinformation and what is not, what are real potential threats, right? And there's a lot of them out there. And again, also to be able to explain why an insurance policy is completely unjustifiable with the things you already have in place, and why you should be going back to argue to the insurance company, look at what we've done. You're telling me that this is not sufficient. Tell me why, because you're not necessarily the expert, Mr. Insurance Company, right?
And this is all pre-work to lead up to being able to walk into last week and have enough ducks in a row. You know, we'll never have all of them, but have enough ducks in a row to be able to have meaningful conversation amongst ourselves as a community with our respective counterparts inside our own organizations about what we have, what we need, where we're going, where the risks are. I'll reiterate my answer from the beginning. I think that the work that we as a community have done to grow the role of information security organizations within our companies, within our businesses, is warranted. And I predict the existence and investment will be confirmed by the outcomes of this particular next few weeks, months, years.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, and I think it also kind of calling attention to the importance for humility in a lot of these incidents, and what's going on, the being able to acknowledge, you know what, we don't know. We don't know what attacks are going to come out, but what we do know is that we've put controls in place. We have the right people on the bus. We have processes. We will respond. we know, I mean, kind of going through doing an inventory, what's our switchboard look like? What controls, what levers do we have to pull if something happens? And I think that's what we did in setting the tone, kind of as this incident continues to escalate. All right, what are we already authorized to do? So for instance, looking at us, we've already got the buy-in from top down. We can take any manufacturing globally facility offline and it's our decision. There's no red tape. If I feel that it's a threat, we can do that. It's important to have those conversations up front, because again, we don't know what's going to happen, but it's good to know what levers do we have to pull when something happens to contain and stop the spread of some type of event.
No, that's actually pretty amazing that you have the ability to do that, which means that you and the business have come together to talk about certain outcomes. And with that, Dan, I wanted to also bring up Maersk and what happened. This goes back to, yeah. Oh man, that was
2017.
Not earlier than that.
Yeah. Was it?
But one of the lessons learned out of there, and one of the only reasons Maersk was able to come back online, was they had a location located down in the southern part of South Africa that completely was offline, unconnected to their network. And they were able to fly down there and pull out all the disc and everything else, put it inside a bag and fly it all the way back to Europe and be able to rebuild, or else they were looking at losing absolutely everything because of a similar type of wiper that was out there that just corrupted and ripped everything out. And I say, think about that, because the lesson learned there was we had to have at least one part of our business, and they didn't know it at the time. They almost, what some would say, was got lucky. And it's learning from those failures over the last X number of years that you can turn to other people in the field that you work with, to ask for their support, lessons learned. That's why we get together and talk about lessons learned. Some of them are going to be failures, and the business needs to understand that. And we learn from those and we move on.
And it was 2017.
Are you saying a wise person?
It was 2017.
It was 2017. Okay. So are you saying a wise person learns from others' mistakes?
Yes.
Yeah. But if you think about it, that's why, if you think about, look at some of our architectures, you know, that we've started to go to the whole concept of immutable backups and things like that, that we've acknowledged again, that we don't know what the next attack is going to look like, but we have to have those, that just having a backup isn't good enough anymore, that there's a third kind of pillar that we have to build into that. And that's just the world we now live in, that it's, you have to anticipate the chaos monkey. And what you can anticipate about the chaos monkey is you can't anticipate what it's going to do, right? That it's going to be absolute chaos, and making sure that we've got the mitigating controls to a certain extent that we can recover from it. And it's a fine line. And this is, we walk this every day, because you can't spend $1,000 to protect $100. Right. So you're finding, you have to define those risk tolerances, and you have to understand what the risk appetite is. And it's, I don't want to say it's a game, but it's an art is the way I'll
it is an art. And it's also ever changing. The fact that when you press down on one, when you squish the bug at one area, or the attack vector at one area, it's going to come up a different place in a different manner. So, you know, the cynical side of me says we're continuing to perpetuate our own existence as roles and as features, because we keep blocking it, and we know that they'll have to change, and it'll require the expertise to be able to understand where they're going or how it manifests itself next, and be able to quickly adapt and respond. But the reality is that, I mean, this is a manifestation of there is an intent, a continued intent, and a continued desire to affect these issues on others, on corporations, on businesses, on people, on citizenry, on governments. All of these things are targets. The technology and mechanisms are there. The impact is working. And therefore, the people doing it will continue to do so. So we need to remember and think that, you know, think ahead, and know that when we squash one, it's going to pop up somewhere else, and we're going to have to deal with it. And the chaos monkeys, I think, is a great way to look at it. And if you haven't played with the software, it's actually quite great. Netflix put out these chaos monkeys probably a decade ago now. You can, if you're really confident in your network in times of of calm in times of not war, you can start to release this tech, and I put the link in the show notes, to start, basically it's the equivalent of monkeys in your data center starting to pull cables out. And if you have your resiliency in place, if you have redundancy, if you have availability, all of these things are, your network should never see any impact. Your system should never see any impact if you've designed it right. And the other thing is, you know, we've made these controls. We've, you know, you talked about different types of immutable backup. And in previous episodes, we've talked about the change in ransomware and what has happened because we now, as culture, have better backups. We now have the ability to restore. Guess what? We took away a mechanism for that particular attack vector to make to be financially viable. And so the attack vector changed. They're going to continue to change. They're going to continue to evolve. And that is what makes this role, one, so interesting, two, so necessary. So until we are out of a space where technology is, you know, technology is key to the things we do, I think that, again, reinforces the role, reinforces the importance, and reinforces the work that information security teams do. And I think they're getting, we as a collective are getting smarter about doing it in line and in benefit of the organizations we serve, rather than just pure dogma of yes and no, and you can't do that. And I think that's making us all far more effective.
And three, so stressful. Oh.
Yes, exactly. No, as Brian shows us his Chrome Dome.
It is interesting, because I know we probably have all gotten the question, how do you sleep at night? And you know, I think for the majority of us, and or maybe I'm just speaking for me, that you know, the answer is I sleep just fine, right? You can only do so much. And once you acknowledge that we've put the pieces in play, we know what the processes are, we know how to respond to whatever is thrown at us, you do sleep better. Things are going to happen. Acknowledge that.
And the idea, you know, I don't want to tie this to what we do to some of the things that exist, some of the mental behavioral challenges that exist in our field. But there's something that's, I think, something that's part of AA, that's part of a lot of the recovery processes that really is valid in this point. You know, the idea that I can accept the things I can change, I can't change, and the courage to change what I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And, you know, there's no such thing as perfection in this field. There is doing what we can and what makes sense in light of the risk. And, you know, that's the best we can do. And, you know, sleeping at night sometimes gets interrupted by phone calls because things happen. But at the end of the day, I go to bed knowing that I've done the best I can, and my teams have done the best they can, and that we have set up a posture that lets us do what we need to. It won't be perfect. It never will be perfect. And once you get that out of your head, it's a lot easier. The rest is a lot easier.
Amen.
And on that note, unfortunately, we've come to the end of another great security debate. Eric, Brian, thank you so much. And to you, the listener, thank you so much. We really appreciate you being here. And we'd love to know what you think of this episode or any of the episodes. Feedback at greatsecuritydebate is our email address. Our Twitter is at securitydebate. And our website is www.greatsecuritydebate.net. We want to hear from you. Please let us know what you think. We have a YouTube channel. Please go take a look at it. I am not going to implore that you subscribe and click the bell and all of those other things that YouTube people do, because we just want to use it as a vehicle to get the visual version out to you. But if you want to go take a look at it there, go for it. The link is in the show notes if you're listening to this in audio. If you're already on YouTube, well, then you know where the channel is. We will see you again soon on the next Great Security Debate.